Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Rich Lenkoff from Downey & Lenkoff and Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery. She's not able to jump on with us today. She has a family matter she's attending to, but we will roll on regardless. For years, a Maryland law professor was convinced the best way to protect women from domestic violence was through arrests and prosecutions. Now she's kind of changed her perspective, and she's here to talk with us about that. Professor Lee Goodmark, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Professor, yeah, Ryan set it up. Could you explain to us sort of why the change in perspective on this very important issue?
Well, the first thing that happened to me was that I started representing clients. And those clients in family matters, including protective orders and divorces and other kinds of things, said from the beginning, criminalization isn't what we want. It's not helping us. Arresting and prosecuting our partners is not doing the work that we need it to do. We need financial assistance. We need emotional support. We love our partners. We want to co-parent with our partners. But this thing that you're giving us, criminal legal system, is not doing the work. And then when I became an academic, I continued to represent clients, but I also started to do the research. And the more research I did, the more I became convinced that, in fact, criminalization was not decreasing or deterring intimate partner violence. It was making many of the things that correlate with the perpetration of violence worse, and it was having unintended consequences for survivors of violence that I don't think we really understood when we started to advocate for these policies back in the late 70s, early 80s.
Let's get into some of those unintended consequences in a second here, but what kind of data do you have backing up your hypothesis?
So I have a whole book full of data. The book is called Decriminalizing Domestic Violence, and there are all kinds of social science studies that show a variety of things. One, that arrest is not decreasing or deterring intimate partner violence. Two, that prosecution doesn't have a conclusive effect on intimate partner violence. That incarceration similarly doesn't have a conclusive effect on intimate partner violence. That, in fact, experiencing trauma in the way that people do when they're incarcerated exacerbates violence. That economic distress also exacerbates violence, something that most people who are incarcerated experience when they're released from incarceration. So not only do the tools that we're using don't have good data to back them up, but the things that we're doing are making the problem worse.
So you mentioned the unintended consequences. What are those?
Many, many, many survivors of violence are brought into the criminal legal system as a result of calling for help. So they come into the criminal legal system as victims when they call for help and they are not believed. They can be prosecuted for obstruction of justice. If they change their story, they can be prosecuted for perjury. They come in as witnesses. Prosecutors regularly use material witness warrants to hold people until they testify. That can be a day, a week, a month, 6 months locked up in jail with no rights, not even the rights that attach to criminal defendants. And then lots of people get arrested. So police show up at the scene of a case of intimate partner violence, and it's he said, she said, and they can't disentangle who did what to whom, and maybe somebody's got injuries on them and somebody doesn't. In the late 70s, early 80s, we adopted these policies called mandatory arrest policies that required police to make an arrest anytime they came to a scene of intimate partner violence. And after the inception of those policies, arrest rates rose significantly, not surprisingly, but they rose for women more than anyone else. And what the later research shows is they didn't rise for women because women had all of a sudden become more violent. They rose for women because of the way that police were implementing those policies. And that was most true for Black and Brown women.
So, Professor, in the gender violence clinic at University of Maryland, does it come as a surprise to students and perhaps others who are aware of the approach you're taking that you are in favor of decriminalizing domestic violence offenders, but that you're also, you know, pro-victim? I mean, how do those two things correlate and how do you explain that to your students and to others?
It does come as a surprise to them. And in fact, we have changed the name recently to the Gender Prison and Trauma Clinic to give our students a better sense of what it is they're coming to do, because many of them thought they were going to come into this clinic and prosecute people or otherwise break up relationships or, you know, do the kinds of things that normal domestic violence clinics do. And we talk a lot about the things that you and I have talked about already, about the way that these policies are operating on survivors of violence. They represent criminalized survivors of violence. And so some of our clients are kind of the classic self-defense, fought back against a partner, ended up incarcerated for it. And some of them are more attenuated, or some of them are kind of using in order to self-medicate as a result of a relationship, and they're incarcerated. They come to see how the system works and how that system hurts the people who it should have been protecting, and how that protection is so illusory for our clients. And by the end of it, you know, even my students who come out as prosecutors, and some of them do, many defense attorneys, but some prosecutors as well, I think have a much better understanding of the power and the tools of the criminal legal system and the real harm that it can do when it those tools and that power are wielded without being thoughtful about that impact.
I wonder, Professor, if you've got an opinion, we haven't discussed this, but on a recent high profile example of, you know, some of these issues playing out. Mel Gibson, of course, was in the news within the last couple of weeks because the U.S. pardon attorney, who's a Justice Department official, was fired. She alleges because she refused to reinstate Mel Gibson's right to own a gun. Of course, Mel Gibson was convicted many years ago of being involved in domestic violence. After we were partially after we heard about the, you know, we heard the tapes and we heard the victim, who is his partner at the time. Again, this allegation is that she was fired because she refused to give him his gun back. And of course, this led to a lot of, I think, very interesting discussion about the dangers of allowing domestic violence abusers of possessing guns. How does this example sort of play into what you're talking about?
In decriminalizing domestic violence, I talk about how important it is for us to get guns out of people's hands. Guns and intimate partner violence are really highly correlated. You're five times more likely to be killed in a domestic violence situation if there's a gun in the home. Clearly, guns are doing a tremendous amount of harm. You know, I am one of those people who believes that nobody needs to have a gun, but really, people who've been abusive certainly don't need to have guns. And so the pardon attorney was doing her job. She was following the law, which says that once you've been convicted of a crime of domestic violence, you should not have access to a firearm.
So do you think that, in summing up, that the trend is in favor of the approach that you're advocating for? Or do you think we still have a long way to go to convince people that you should decriminalize this kind of behavior?
The trend is not in the direction that I am aiming for, but I hope that even if people aren't willing to go all the way to decriminalization, they are willing to be thoughtful about the things that we can do along the way to decrease the incidence of intimate partner violence on the front end, and to think about how our interventions are causing harm on the back end. So things like mandatory arrest, we don't have to have those policies. We could get rid of them tomorrow, and that would be a significant help. We can think about what offender intervention programming looks like. We've used a model of offender intervention programming that I think is pretty ineffective, because what it doesn't acknowledge is all of the other things that are going on in somebody's life, the trauma that they've experienced, the economic distress that they're experiencing, that we know from the research are correlated with this problem. So even if you're not willing to come all the way with me, I think there are things along the way towards complete decriminalization that we can agree about that would have a tremendous impact on intimate partner violence.
One last question, Professor, we'll let you go. You know, we've discussed in depth on this podcast over the last several months this lawsuit involving the film It Ends With Us, right? Between Justin Baldoni, the director, Blake Lively, the star. She alleges that she was sexually harassed. He alleges that he was defamed. One of the biggest, you know, stories litigation-wise in many years, and it continues. I mean, it's going on right now. There's some news today. Of course, that film deals with domestic violence. How has that film played out? I'm sure you're covering it, right? It's a very high profile example of how this is depicted in the media. How is that playing out in your teachings and your discussions?
You know, films like It Ends With Us are problematic for us because they're so different than the ordinary person's experience with intimate partner violence. it's hard to take a film like that and say, when you have somebody who's got lots of resources and all kinds of other things, they have options that are very different than the vast majority of our clients. So part of what we do is to kind of pick through, okay, what resources does this person have available to her, as opposed to what resources do our clients have available to them? And wouldn't we love it if everybody had the capacity to address the problem in a particular way? Not everybody does. And so just thinking about kind of the systemic and structural things that we need to have in place for everybody to have a safe alternative to the relationship that they're in.
All right. So the name of the book is Decriminalizing Domestic Violence. I just looked it up. I got it pulled up right now on Amazon. A Balanced Policy Approach to Intimate Partner Violence, 2018. So 216 pages. Go out and get it. Go get a read of that. University of Maryland Law Professor and Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development, Lee Goodmark. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and Leading Lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. A federal appeals court has revived a First Amendment retaliation claim by a professor at the University of Illinois Chicago School of Law over an apparent racist word used in an exam question. It led to an investigation, required diversity training, a suspension, and denial of a pay raise. That professor, actually, Jason Kilbourn, joins us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Professor, you were employed by University of Illinois Chicago School of Law. The incident that Ryan is referring to occurred back in December of 2020 during a final exam in civil procedure in which you included a hypothetical involving a party alleging that her managers had called her a N-word and a B-word. Now, it's important that we be specific because the exam said the word, quote, N with several dashes, and B with several dashes. Talk to us, pick it up from that point.
Well, so the idea was to not be gratuitously obnoxious to the students, but to prompt them to realize that this is the kind of obnoxious language that one encounters, and it really heightened the desire by the student lawyer to conceal this information from the other side. And I really wanted to press the people to answer the question correctly, which was indeed, you have to release the fact that this woman had such a thing, no matter how badly you might not want to. I had to include something really obnoxious like that without being gratuitous, and that's why I said N space, which surprisingly enough to me was then called using the this word and created this huge firestorm.
So a couple of students were upset, I guess, and they took it to the administration. What happened at that point?
Well, the administration called me in and said, you know, I know this is going to make you upset, but, you know, these students were upset about your use of the N-word on your exam. And I said, whoa, I did not use the N-word there or any time other in my life. What I wrote was N space, and I offered the explanation I just gave to you. My dean said, oh, totally clear now, misunderstanding. Maybe you should send a message to the class. This is, listen, if anybody felt any kind of way about that, sorry about that. We're happy to talk to you, but, you know, there it was. And we sort of thought it had ended then, but it just escalated from there.
There was another incident involving a discussion on race-based traffic stops, the appeals court said, where you used African-American vernacular English accent while repeating lyrics to a Jay-Z song. In response to that, ultimately, you weren't given a across-the-board 2% merit raise and said you couldn't return to the classroom until you completed an 8-week diversity training program. Pick it up from there.
Well, so when my dean responded relatively positively, as I just described, the people who had complained about this wanted to pursue their agenda more aggressively. And so they recruited some student to claim that a year earlier, mind you, a year earlier, I had said some things that were like so offensive that they ought to be characterized as harassing my African-American students in that class. One of which, and this is frankly my favorite example of this, is they pointed out that I had used this African-American vernacular English accent when quoting a Jay-Z lyric. What in fact I had said was, I was trying to contrast the topic of the case, which was alleged discrimination against a Muslim prisoner, and I said, well, how is this different from, you know, traffic stops in the south side of Chicago all the time, you know, where the cop sort of goes, as Jay-Z says, you was doing 55 in a 54. That's exactly what I said, exactly how I said it. The entire class tittered with delight at this old bald white guy quoting Jay-Z from the Run mix that he was listening to that morning. Everyone was perfectly happy. And of course, the semester concludes with no one saying boo about anything. Now, a year later, out of nowhere, here comes this crazy allegation that was harassment of my black students. And again, I mean, it just beggars belief that these DEI offices just create something out of nothing like this.
So how did this end up in court, and how did we end up in the Seventh Circuit with their decision that Ryan referenced at the start of our show?
Well, I mean, your first question was a really good one, in that this should never have come anywhere near a court. This should have been confined to the law school. The dean and an assistant dean, I think, did a fairly admirable job of dealing with it, sending the sort of regret notice and going, listen, let's just not do this again. We're going to monitor your class for a few semesters, and if we see anything untoward, then maybe we'll do something extra. Are we good with that? And I was like, fine, we'll just let it drop. Of course, a few months later, interrupts the UIC Central Administration, who doesn't know me, doesn't know the law school, doesn't know anything whatsoever about legal education of the law school, and they decide to suspend me for another semester, make me take this, you know, sensitivity training on no basis whatsoever. That, by the way, the very first reading I was assigned contains the exact same abbreviation that I had used, that white people might, you know, worry that their friends would call them N-space lover if they support that. I mean, it was, once again, you cannot make this stuff up. So I sued. I was like, listen, you don't mess with a Northern Lutheran Midwesterner's money. And when they denied me the 2% raise, I was like, forget this. I'm not putting up with this. I'm going to sue to tell, you know, ignorant, feckless administrators that you need to stay in your lane over there. I'm a law professor. You don't have any idea what you're talking about. Don't tell me what to say or not say on my exam and in my classroom. I sued under the First Amendment. And the district judge, through two rounds of motions to dismiss over about 2 years, dismissed my case twice, holding that my discussions in the classroom were not on a matter of public interest, which again beggars belief. And so we appealed instantly, like 2 days after her second ruling. We appealed, we argued it before the Supreme Court with magnificently written briefs, and we won. The Supreme Court, the Seventh Circuit decided what I had said indeed was not a matter of public interest, and that these administrators have nothing to say about intervening in a law school classroom, despite the fact that I'm a public employee.
What repercussions do you think this has on teaching in law schools and the First Amendment in general?
Well, the repercussions of the administrator's actions are to vastly chill the speech and creativity of people in the classroom, because I, for a long time, and many of my colleagues were quite afraid to have the kinds of meaningful discussions and to discuss sort of, you know, sharp-edged cases that we wanted to discuss in class for fear, again, of retribution by ignorant, feckless administrators. The impact of my case is the very reason I set out to do this. The impact of my case is, I think, quite clearly to indicate to public university administrators, you stay in your lane. You're not allowed to regulate the conduct, the speech conduct of people in their classrooms or their scholarship, so you stay over there. And this should have been obvious to you, by the way, so you have personal liability for violating this guy's rights. The second step, by the way, is a few days after that decision was released, I communicated with a professor in Indiana who is involved, I think maybe indirectly, with a challenge to Indiana government's attempt to control the kinds of things that people in Indiana and public universities say in their classrooms. And they're now using that case to support their position that, listen, once again, it's not the government's position to intrude into a law school classroom and tell a law professor what he or she cannot say in his or her own classroom.
Professor, this decision, the Seventh Circuit decision, was authored by Judge Thomas Lee Kirsch II, who was appointed by Trump in his first administration. You mentioned DEI earlier. You can't look at this case without considering the current climate of DEI. We'll be covering in a few minutes in our grab bag segment the decision of Trump to rescind his executive order targeting Paul Weiss after they agreed to drop DEI hiring practices. We've seen with the new Trump administration countless companies dropping their DEI practices after Trump has railed against them. So how do you think this decision falls into that spectrum?
I think it is largely unrelated to that entire movement of things. I mean, it's tenuously connected only in that all of the backlash against this DEI that we're seeing from the Trump administration comes from the horrifically myopic position of the DEI industry up to this point, which is valuing and evaluating people and things only on who they are rather than what they're saying and what the substance is. And Trump is and his administration have said, enough of this. We need to stop evaluating and assessing people based on who they are fundamentally, immutable characteristics, and start refocusing on things like merit and skill and hard work, et cetera. So, again, I don't think that my case has much to do with the DEI, anti-DEI movement, but it certainly is an example of what DEI run amok can produce.
Is this the end of this case, or is the other side going to appeal?
I don't think there's going to be another level of appeal, because I highly doubt that the University of Illinois is going to be willing to spend the money to pursue a cert petition. I don't think the Supreme Court would grant it, even if they were pursuing it. A, because every single circuit who's held on this matter is held exactly as the Seventh Circuit did. And frankly, B, I mean, I just would be very, very surprised if after spending $1.25 million, $1.25 million fighting a law professor about his speech in his classroom, if UI is really going to have the stomach to continue to fight me. If they do, incidentally, I'm very, very pleased to engage in discovery. I'm a civil procedure professor, very, very happy to proceed to discovery and continue to air UI's dirty laundry as to how it treats us in the classroom and the kinds of nonsense DEI investigations to which it's subjected me and other people. So we'll see what happens. We've made them a settlement offer, and it's in their court now.
With public funds, right? I mean, it's a public, you know, state law school, so that's all public funds being used for this lawsuit.
Exactly. The University of Illinois system, including UIC, is backed by a series of funds that support, you know, litigation defense, and those funds, of course, are funded by public money. It really is absolutely gut-wrenching that as the University of Illinois complains about funding cuts, it's wasting money left and right on this completely nonsense case that should have settled for $0 4 years ago.
We'll have to leave it there. Professor Kilbourn, thank you so much for joining us and telling your side of the story on this.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined today by Sanford Williams, law professor at the potentially bracket-busting UCLA, and Ryan Douglas, vice president of property and casualty at USI Insurance Services, that's in the Seattle area. Both of you guys are repeat offenders here on the Legal Grab Bag. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, as is tradition, we start off with Trump Watch. And Rich, today we can talk about, well, a lot of things. AutoPen, we can talk about some of the struggles the president is having in the courts. Where do you want to take this?
I mean, there's a lot. You know, I'm very interested in Trump as he is dealing with these law firms, you know, mostly big law. He is going after them for them representing parties in the impeachment process. So, you know, Everyone feared that, or many people, I sound like Trump already. Many people are saying that Trump was going to go after his enemies. And I don't think people understood the degree to which he's doing that. And one of the ways is going after law firms. I mean, this idea of going after private law firms for representing part, that's what law firms do, right? But he's getting his way. I mean, this latest news is that he is rescinding his executive order because one of the firms is agreeing to spend a lot of money on pro bono work. Paul Weiss, the head of Paul Weiss, met with Trump, and they agreed to rescind their DEI efforts in exchange for him rescinding the executive order. I mean, this is crazy stuff that the leader of the free world is leaning on the head of a law firm to stop DEI practices. And they're negotiating this deal. It's just crazy. The other story that we talked about is, you know, again, like any one of these stories in normal life, Sanford, would be the most earth-shattering story ever. It's gone in a day. The fact that Trump says that his predecessor's pardons are null and void because they were used by AutoPen. Like, that's kind of a big deal. So what? Now Trump is going to go after all the people that Biden, including the January 6th committee that he pardoned. Be careful, Trump, because perhaps the same thing will be argued against all the people that you pardon, including thousands of January 6th insurrectioners. Right. So this stuff is nuts. It's very, you know, it's a little distressing legally. But what are your thoughts, Sanford, on the mess? This is only a small percentage of things.
Exactly. Well, I should say, in addition to working at UCLA Law School, I am still employed by the federal government, so I'll be careful about my comments about Trump. But I was a couple things. With the pardon, I mean, Article 2, Section 2 clearly says pardons can be granted by president, so they're not revocable. So you can't go back and revoke, you know, what Biden did. And the AutoPen thing is not really a starter, because many constitutional scholars have said folks have done that previously. And not only that, there are folks, I think even George Bush, who had someone sign for him. So it's really a non-starter. And like you said, in normal times, this would be a big story. But the fact that he's articulating this is kind of crazy. And then circle back to your law firm thing. I have tons of friends at law firms, and they are really, really worried about what may happen if they run afoul of the administration. And it'll be interesting to see how folks proceed going forward. But it's very unusual and very strange. And I was very interested that the firm kind of acquiesced to what the president asked for, because it surprised me a little bit.
Yeah, Ryan, the other one that's like getting a lot of attention is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, took the very unusual step of publicly calling out Trump and reminding President Trump that you're not allowed to impeach a judge because you disagree with a ruling. There's a process by which you disagree with a judge's ruling. It's called appeal, right? And I'm talking, of course, about this judge's decision that Trump can't just deport people at will, right? And of course, Trump came out and criticized this judge and said that he's a, you know, he's woke and he's liberal, and this is because of who appointed him. It's very unusual for the Supreme Court Chief Justice to come out and remind Trump that that's not proper, but that's what he did. So, and that's after, by the way, Trump thanked Roberts during the State of the Union for some unnamed favor that Roberts did him. So this is all nuts.
Well, it's about time the Supreme Court has the ability to stand up and fight for what is right and accurate. To your point, judicial disagreements, you know, ultimately they're a healthy part of the legal system. There's appropriate recourse for process. And the fact that Judge Roberts stood up, you know, is I think is a positive of a result as you're going to get at the level of the Supreme Court. You know, this case, I think, is the case in and of itself that is, you know, in dispute is also, you know, such a hot topic with, you know, the deportation of immigrants to Venezuela, you know, on the cusp of, you know, one evening, you know, there's plenty of legal recourse that's going to come from this. You know, it feels like, and this isn't a stab against Republicans or Democrats, but just the political establishment that we are living in is very much so a tit for tat sort of, you did this, so we're going to do this. You know, and, you know, Biden administration did the same about the January 6th. You know, we're going to come after you because you came after us and vice versa. I think that, you know, this political discord is gotten to a point where the general U.S. populace is just tired of it. Unfortunately, the core main news outlets haven't really understood what we need as consumers, which isn't the headline driven. It's, you know, maybe have the ability to show us both sides of the coin. So, yeah, just, you know, further discord.
Yeah, I mean, we'll let this topic go because we could talk about it for the full 30 minutes. But you know, this idea that we might be in a constitutional crisis at some point, we are in a constitutional crisis. When you have the executive branch criticizing the judicial branch as crooked because you disagree with their ruling and you are openly violating a federal court order and you're calling a judge, who has ever called a federal district court judge a local judge? They're talking about this federal court judge, by the way, which is part of the federal judiciary. They're calling this judge a local judge as if he's like in a one room courthouse somewhere in like the middle of America. He's a federal district court judge. This is what they do. He's not a local judge. And to call his ruling a local rule, I mean, it's just nuts. It's just, right. It's that boggles the mind, but you know,
you're right. Well, you can't just impeach somebody because you
want to. Yeah, well, let's just impeach him. By the way, by someone who said that you can't, that impeachment, he was impeached twice and he fought against impeachment. Now he's in favor of impeachment.
All right, let's cool off from the politics for a second. So here's a follow-up story we did back in the fall. Miley Cyrus faces a copyright lawsuit for her hit song Flowers, which is a response to Bruno Mars' song, When I Was Your Man. She wants that toss, but Rich, that's not going to happen, is it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little technical. We don't have to get into the weeds, really. But yeah, on Tuesday of this week, the order was entered denying her motion to dismiss. Again, this is a dispute between Miley Cyrus involving the song Wrecking Ball and the Bruno Mars song, When I Was Your Man, that precedes her hit song by about 10 years. So the lawsuit will continue. We have another similar case coming up here in a moment. But, you know, Ryan, it sort of underscores the idea that these days, if you've got a hit song, guaranteed you're going to be sued almost, right? Someone wants their piece of any hit song, and it's more prevalent than ever. I think the other sort of good news as someone who defends some of these type of lawsuits is that we have better knowledge than ever. We have better experts than ever, better technology than ever to weed out some of these frivolous lawsuits. By the other, you know, by the flip of that is like musicians will tell you that there's only so many sort of chords out there in the world and every song is somewhat derivative of the other. The question in these cases becomes frequently how much you're going to pay to avoid these cases going forward.
Yeah, and I wonder if in this case, is it less about that actual copyright and more about the interpretation of the legal aspect of the rights of ownership? So there's the exclusive right, and then there's exclusive ownership of rights. And that's the nuance here, you know, where Miley Cyrus's song Flowers isn't actually coming up all roses.
Right.
Yeah.
Because of those minor nuances.
There we go.
You're welcome.
I hear music all day, every day from my daughter, who's I think a fabulous songwriter. And I listened to both songs carefully, didn't really hear a commonality, but I did look at the lyrics, which my daughter always urges me to do. And quickly, Bruno Mars' song says, I should have bought you flowers and held your hand, should have given you all my hours. Miley Cyrus's chorus says, I can buy myself flowers, write my name in the sand, talk to myself for hours. It looks like it's a play exactly word for word of what he did. So the music and the melody, I really didn't quite kind of catch that, but the words, it seems that she's replying to his song.
What the hell else are you going to do with flowers and music? I mean, it reminds me of the, what was that Barbara Streisand song? You Don't Bring Me Flowers Anymore? Mm-hmm. Are you going to say that that's derivative of that song that's like 50 years old? I mean,
yeah. You
know.
Well, but even worse, like he said, now my baby's dancing. She says, I can take myself dancing, you know. Yeah. So I see the commonality. I saw it more than I did when I listened to it.
Well, the interesting piece is here, not that it's always, you know, you're frequently dealing with the owners of the publishing, but you don't often see two megastars. I mean, these are, you know, two AA list musicians that are embroiled in this lawsuit. It's often a lesser musician trying to get a piece of the bigger pie.
I do want to point out that it's not Bruno Mars that's suing Miley Cyrus, by the way. It's Tempo Music, which acquired the rights to the song. So just so you know, I think they're friendly with each other, but I don't know. Maybe not after this. All right. Well, another indication that time is a flat circle. This is 2025, not 1992, but a California man has won a $50 million lawsuit over burns suffered from spilled Starbucks tea. Does this remind anyone of a story from the 90s? Yeah.
I mean, you know, the subject of a lot of confusion over the years was the McDonald's hot coffee case. There was a good documentary. A lot of people don't know some of the details of the McDonald's hot coffee case, including that, you know, I represent McDonald's, so I shouldn't talk too much about it. But this is all well known that McDonald's was at the time serving coffee like incredibly hotter than it should have been. And, you know, That was ultimately reduced to about $800,000 or $600,000. They settled the case. In this case, Starbucks, you know, the allegation is that they gave the tea, and there's a video showing it. They gave the tea to this consumer who was in the drive-thru, Sanford, and they didn't properly put it in the tray, and it spilled all over them. Considerable damages, right? $50 million, though. I mean, that's a lot. They rejected, I guess, an offer of $30 million before it went to the verdict. I represent a lot of restaurants, a lot of retailers. $50 million is a lot, and it's one of those cases that stands out that a lot of people talk about. So, you know, it is similar to McDonald's case in many ways.
Yeah, it is. And when I saw $50 million initially, I kind of balked at it. But then when I read the details behind it and saw that he underwent skin grafts and other procedures, you know, on his private area, then I'd say, okay, well, I can kind of see, you know, why that amount of money. I mean, $30 million versus $50 million, I don't know how you can, you know, decide, but I see why there was a substantial verdict for him.
Yeah. Ryan, what do you think when you heard about this one?
Yeah, it's not surprising it happened, because I don't know if you've ever tried to even pull the drinks out of that serving tray, but they're in there pretty tight. And actually, this leads me like down other rabbit holes, because I'm in risk management. Is that tray too tight for, you know, putting in something that is a pretty malleable, especially the warmer it is, you know, when do we get to tender this over to the tray manufacturer? I think this is another example of, punitive damages and or just excessive verdicts impacting one's ability to conduct business. In a free and open market, this happens, from the plaintiff's side. But it also, you know, impacts, ultimately all of us consumers. When Starbucks is paying out $50 million, you know, a business has a way to recoup, either through insurance products, which I serve a lot of, the net cost ultimately comes back out of consumers' pockets.
Yeah.
Just when investors and investors don't like losing money. So it tends to be us consumers.
Yeah, because everything revolves back to Seinfeld. Apparently this man did not put the balm on, so that's good. That's why you won the lawsuit.
Well, they didn't accept the first offer of coffee. I'll take it.
Yeah. For
All right. The Girl Scouts are being sued because those cookies we buy and scarf down without thinking about it, maybe loaded with metals and pesticides. Wonderful. I'm going to demand a refund from my relatives.
Yeah. I mean, who knew that they were so delicious, because, they were laced with things like glyphosate, which is a pesticide that is used in some weed killers, with Thin Mints, Ryan, being having the highest levels. Allegedly, this is what this lawsuit, proposed class action lawsuit that was filed on Monday in federal court in New York, in Brooklyn, says that this 113-year-old nonprofit, the Girl Scouts, is selling cookies through their distributors, through their producers, with, in addition to the pesticide that I mentioned, things like aluminum, arsenic, cadmium, lead, and mercury, which all are, you know, not what you're looking for when you're buying those coconut. What are the coconut ones called? I don't like the coconut ones.
Yeah, what are the Samoas, right? Samoas.
Oh, I'm in favor of the Thin Mints. I'm just curious if the Thin Mints are a little heavier with these heavy metals in them. I'm not sure, but certainly hard to call them Thin Mints when they got heavy metals. In my world, this comes back to, a strength of contract. I can guarantee that the Girl Scouts have never manufactured or made a cookie themselves ever. You know, they've got their manufacturers that they're the ones that are actually doing. I think the article mentions it's like ABC Bakery and another one that, are the manufacturers of this product. And it comes back to, you know, the strength of a contract that you have with your manufacturer. If you've got a contract that has the ability to shift responsibility back through things like additional insured status and then some kind of contractual requirements for things like hold harmless or primary non-contributory language, I suspect that, without being specifically an attorney, that the Girl Scouts of America are going to tender the majority of this claim to the actual manufacturers of said product. An attorney can help me actually answer that, but that's why we coin our policies and our contracts to push back to the responsible parties, allowing for these heavy metals and, you know, other pesticides to get into these cookies.
For sure, for sure. And, you know, there's 200 million boxes sold annually, Sanford. Here's my favorite part of this lawsuit brought by an individual named Amy Mayo in Bayside, New York. And again, as someone who defends a lot of these kind of cases, a lot of products liability cases, alleging that products are sold with things that shouldn't be in there. And many of them are nonsense. Many of them are BS. This is my favorite line from the lawsuit. Are you ready? Everyone ready?
Yeah.
Mayo says that she would not have bought the cookies. Okay, that we understand. Or, quote, would have paid substantially less. And the Girl Scouts disclosed the presence of these dangerous items. Let's get this straight, ma'am. Let's say this is your deposition.
Right.
So you're objecting to the $279 right. You're paying for the Thin Mints. But, you know, if they were half price, maybe right. The sides are okay.
Right.
If they were marked as such, maybe marked down, you know, today only pesticide included, therefore I'm going to pay like a buck for them. That would be okay. I mean, come on.
Yeah, that kind of cuts against our case. I mean, give me $2. I mean, so you'll die, boxes, but you don't want it now. I mean, I do think one of the compelling things is the pesticide that was supposedly used in weed killers. That's kind of disturbing. And it's kind of hard, too, because I think Ryan made some great points. The Girl Scouts don't make the cookies, but people associate the cookies with them. So they're suffering, you know, all the fallout from this, things that they really didn't bargain for. But as Ryan had mentioned, you know, it's something that they have to work out with their attorneys. I hope it's not true because I have a bunch of boxes in my closet and I've been giving them to my 2-year-old grandson. So, I hope he's not eating metal and plastic.
Well, maybe had she known, like, I wonder what that Girl Scout box would say. Today, extra arsenic in the, today only half off for the arsenic Thin Mints.
Maybe if they switch producers, they'll bring back the s'mores because they haven't had those for the last couple of years. And I really like those ones. So, all right, moving on. Norway's ski jumping team. It's big there, Rich. You know that? Ski jumping. That's like the Super Bowl they've got. I actually talked to ski jumpers. They said it's that big. Well, they've been caught up in a cheating scandal. Big deal.
Yeah, the allegation is that several individuals were involved in cheating. They've been provisionally suspended. I wasn't aware of this organization, the International Ski and Snowboard Federation. This is resulting, Ryan, from their participation in the 2025 Federation Nordic World Ski Championships. And the allegation was that they were manipulating ski suits to make them more aerodynamic, that they were using other irregularities in the equipment, Where is the world coming to when we can't rely on the veracity of our ski jumpers? It's problematic for sure.
It is. I was so curious, the article and even, supplementary articles that I've read, no one referenced what they were actually doing to the uniforms that they were wearing. But I know, in the kind of Olympic movement space, allegations have been around for years. Even when Michael Phelps was swimming, there were a few Olympic years that our men's swim team was using full suits, not their, smaller briefs, to try to become aerodynamic. I'm thinking in my mind that they were creating a wingsuit to create extra propulsion, because these are the ones I think that are doing the long jumps. So, you know, if honestly, this is, you know, getting back to the reality of things, you know, if you have a staff that are intentionally manipulating a product that is outside of the guidance of the governing body, that in this case is the FIS, shame on them, and they should be pulled from the sport and at least put on suspension. Where I think it's a little unclear is, do the participants know that they are willing, contributors towards this bad act, or is it just this small staff? Makes me think of Deflategate. Who really knew what the actions of these staffers were?
Well, and Ryan, the allegation is that they added material to the crotch area. I'm not making this up. I don't know. I'm not an expert in this area, but that wouldn't be, to Ryan Douglas's point, where I would think it would help. You're right. You would think that it would be like
exactly.
Wings, but
you think it'd be worse. Now, I have to throw in here, I know that swimming, this happens a lot because they're very, very, very careful with the rules. And one of my alma maters, University of Virginia, the women's team has won for their fifth straight national championship this week. So I got to throw that in there. But for skiing, I've never heard of this before. And yeah, I wonder, like you said, Rich, what could they do to enhance their ability to ski? It doesn't make sense to me. So hopefully they'll figure it out. Maybe, what they're doing is just novel and new, and they need to adapt, whatever they've come up with. Because if it worked and helped the Norwegian team, maybe it can help other people as well. But very strange story.
Next year, you guys all have to come out to the Norgi Ski Club. It's in Fox River Grove here in Illinois, where we actually have three Olympians who compete. It's actually a very, very cool event. It's also a sloppy drunk event by all the fans who are there, but it's very cool, and you learn a lot, and it's terrifying as well. All right, hat tip to Lisa on this headline. We want the funk. George Clinton is suing his former business partner over the ownership rights to his music. Rich.
Now you mentioned, I took a deep dive into the music of George Clinton, of course, on this story, and I don't think he probably holds the records for most uses of the word funk in his musicology. I mean, every other song is some derivation of the word funk, which you got to love. But yeah, another case involving music rights. This one, George Clinton alleges that his former business partner basically forged Clinton's signature on various documents over the years. And George Clinton did not intend to give up his music rights to his partner. This person named Armin Baladian, and he's trying to basically claw back his rights. Now, this is sort of part of the bigger picture, Sanford, that we've seen over the years. A couple issues here. Number one, the prevalence of artists selling their music rights for large sums of money. It seems that they start at a couple hundred million and can go up to a billion or $2 for the right artist. There is a trend to that, I think, in recognition of the fact that a lot of these artists are getting older and you can't take this money with you. And it's a great way to sort of monetize this. But also the idea that even if this contract was valid, which, has yet to be determined, but that artists have the right to own their IP. We saw this very, very prominently in the Taylor Swift issue, where she was reissuing her music. But I think the trend is that the artist should prevail. Anytime there's an allegation that the artist was taken advantage of, you have to sort of look at it as well. You signed it. Were you of good mind when you signed it? And you have to live by the contract. In this case, of course, the allegation is that there was forgery involved. So, big fan of George Clinton and P-Funk and Parliament and all that.
Yeah, it reminds me of college days and hearing this music while we're dancing responsibly. But one thing that really struck me too is that the agent, I think, has like 90% of his catalog. So just from a fairness standpoint, you mentioned Rich, that doesn't really make sense that artists don't have that control. I think that Isaac Hayes' family was one who has done a good job of making sure they have control over his IP. But a lot of artists, as you well know, are not well versed in the industry. And, you want to make a quick buck and you sign away and you don't realize how much it's worth. And something needs to be done to help them, obtain the money and the things that they deserve because of the fruits of their labor.
What was really 100%, what was really compelling, Ryan, in the allegations of this complaint were two things. Number one, that They allege that this partner, the defendant, Baladian, was using fake songwriters, was making up names like L. Crane and B. Blaine, who don't exist. I mean, to me, that's pretty compelling. If it's true, that's pretty compelling evidence of fraud. And number two, that Baladian was not only possessing the rights, but he was going after others who, you know, in copyright cases, who he alleged were ripping off Clinton. But Clinton never saw a penny of any of that. So, you know, if he's to be believed, this guy had, you know, he had some quijones to not only like rip off Clinton, but to go after others who he said were ripping off Clinton, but not getting any of those funds.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. And it sounds like this is more of a tiff than it is of the kind of the responsibilities and struggle. From what the defense counsel said, or the defense attorney said, that this has been really going on for 30 years, and that in each case that George Clinton has brought up with similar allegations, that they have all been found to have lost that battle. So, you know, we'll let the court see, but I can't help but, you know, try to understand it and hear it from George Clinton's side because of just his fame and popularity. And we want to see him win, but, you know, it doesn't sound like he's been as fruitful as his efforts have been.
Yeah, you're right. He's lost many times. He's made similar allegations.
We'll close with this. Rich, another young woman with a smiling mugshot has broken the internet, this time in Georgia.
Well, can we, I didn't ask Lisa, but maybe we could pull it up here in a second. But yeah, we've covered, you know, one of our favorite topics on Legal Face Off over 10 years is mugshots, celebrity mugshots, some bad, some good. This woman is a new celebrity, Ryan and Sanford, because of, you know, she's a very attractive young lady. And she was arrested by the Georgia State Patrol on March 8th. For speeding more than the maximum limits. I think she was doing like 75 and a 55. And then she got pulled over right after again. And after the second time she was pulled over, they took her into custody. And, you know, I mean, listen, I've never thankfully had a mugshot, but I don't know. Yeah, I guess stop, put on some makeup, do your hair, make it look the best, and break the internet. Some of the comments, the inevitable comments, have been must have been a sale of Lululemon. The smile says, my daddy is an attorney. Guilty of stealing my heart, Your Honor. Wait, there she was. She's gone. Where was she? We saw her for a second. Ryan, could you show us what your mugshot would look like? Would it look as good as this?
I could guarantee it's not going to consist of a smile. That's number one. this is just goes to show how social media has kind of taken over so much of our world, that it pays to get clicks. And there's going to be it's either going to be on whichever platform, but there's going to be now, you know, most beautiful mugshots, and folks who are rating it. And, you know, individuals like we have here, you know, hopefully she can figure out how to monetize this process. So we'll yet to be seen, but I know for a fact for her, you know, her Instagram following has grown by, you know, thousands of percent. You know, it's interesting to think, but this is sometimes people's big break.
100%. And we had, by the way, Lisa, we got a book, we got a book, Lily Stewart, on, because we did have the last one that went viral. We had her on, very nice young lady. We got to see if we can get Lily on. But the key, Sanford, in monetizing this and using it is to come up with a catchy name. You can't just Google like good looking mugshot. You got to be, I think this one is the cheer, right? She's like the sorority mugshot, right? That's her name.
Yeah. 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 Okay, well, I like Ryan's idea. Maybe we can like talk off camera about monetizing this Legal Face Off. We can work with, you know, to have a website to put these photos up. You may not know this, Rich, but Nia, my youngest, was born in Augusta, Georgia. So really Georgia's thing really got me. I don't know the picture. I mean, it's a beautiful picture. More power to her. Hopefully she can monetize it. And I think she said she's on her way to a birthday party. That's why she looked that way. And when you take a picture, you're supposed to smile and show your best side. So she was just, you know, giving her a best shot.
Is it possible that all of those people started following her on Instagram, not because of her looks, but because they like speeding as well?
Yeah.
Those are speeders. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah. Now she was going over almost 30 miles over the limit. So that's a lot. That's a lot.
Let's see. I just started following her. Let's see how many followers she's got. 5,300 followers. I don't even know if that doesn't seem like a lot, but I guarantee after being on Legal Face Off.
But you got to check TikTok though, because that's what young people are, TikTok. You got to check TikTok.
That's right. The TikTok. All right. Let's end off our legal grab bag as we traditionally do with a question I make up really quickly on the fly. We were talking earlier, let's see, about the NCAAs. We want to get back to watching that. How about who do you think is going to win the whole thing this year? Let's start with Ryan Burrow. Ryan Burrow always complains that I go to him first. The advantage of going first, though, is that we have a no repeat rule. So you get to go back at it.
I got the quad up right now on the TV here, so I have not missed a beat. I've got Florida winning it all. Florida. I don't know why. Just had a hunch.
On a limb. Way to really be bold, bro.
Yeah. Ryan Douglas. But my final four also includes Gonzaga, and I've got Creighton beating Auburn. So there you go.
Let's add this question. Who is your favorite college team to root for? Let's add that one, Ryan Burrow.
Valparaiso University. They did not make the tournament this year.
Valpo. All right, good one. Ryan Douglas, favorite team to root for, and who do you got winning this year?
Well, from the Pacific Northwest, it's hard not to have Gonzaga be your it's not even the dark horse anymore. This is just the white horse, but it's in our backyard. My son's got to play a couple basketball games in Gonzaga. I don't even have them going as far as Ryan does because they've got a tough matchup in their next round. I'm thinking University of Houston. Kelvin Sampson was a coach at Washington State University when I was in high school, and we would go to camps there, and they were, time of my life. When I look back at my basketball career, those are the most memorable times, and Kelvin Sampson was a part of that.
Wow. Mark Few, by the way, Gonzaga coach, 16 consecutive first round wins in the NCAA. Yeah, so great program, but tough second round matchup. Sanford, I think we know your answer, but give us, you got a house divide. I mean, UVA, but you got UCLA. You got two good
programs. Easy, bro. UVA everything, except that we're not in the tournament either way. And I'm good friends with Corey Close, the UCLA women's basketball coach. So, and I went to their selection party here in Westwood last week. So I have Auburn winning the men's, UCLA winning the women's title, and then favorite team, again, UVA everything, and UCLA women.
That sound you heard, Ryan Burrow, was name-dropping by Sanford Williams.
I was going to tell him I was at the championship when they won in Minneapolis a few years ago.
So was I. 2019.
Sanford, bring the coach to our Surmanar event.
Hey, she's on my Instagram. We took a picture together. So if she wins it, and we're in a Big Ten, which I still can't believe. But anyway,
How many UVA alums in the family? Four.
Five. All five of us.
Unbelievable. One of the best schools in the country. Let's see. I root for, of course, the Northern Illinois University Huskies. Has been in the tournament maybe once ever. Not this year, for sure. And are moving, though, Ryan Burrow, as you probably have covered, to the Horizon League from the MAC. So we're hoping for good things in the Horizon League. And for the winner, I have to do a duplicate because it's the truth. I picked Houston as well. I think they got a really good team. Lisa, who do you got and who do you like?
I like Purdue, of course. Right. And I have Tennessee winning one of my brackets.
Well, those two don't match. Those two have had some real barn burners between each other.
Yeah, and they're in the same bracket down there.
I picked the upset over Purdue, so my bracket, they survived. Who else you got, Lisa, with you there? Anyone else want to give other picks?
No, they don't really follow basketball.
Very good.
Perfect time to wrap it. Thanks a lot, so much. That'll do it for this week's episode of Legal Face Off. Thank you so much, Ryan Douglas and Sanford Williams, for hopping on. Also, thank you to law professor Jason Kilbourn of University of Illinois Chicago and University of Maryland law professor Lee Goodmark. Also want to give a shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stiegel, Fortina Martini, Rich Lenkoff. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
Go Huskies.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...